everyone. Welcome to another episode of Teaching for Our Time. Today we're going to be talking about eating and drinking and nutrition at the end of life. And I have Cleona Talib from the nutrition team and Bob Chu, our associate specialist, with us today. And Cleona has got loads of insights, so I'm going to jump straight in with her.
Hi. So in this country, I think, and in many countries around the world, debt is a bit of a taboo subject, and many communities feel a little bit unprepared, and it's something that people don't feel that comfortable talking about. So I think, unfortunately, as a result of that, we've almost medicalized what is a natural process. Mm-hmm. And I would say one thing that's very notable is if a woman is pregnant tomorrow, for the next 9 months, she gets 9 months of intervention, of all the care, planning, everything is, support is there for her, support is there at a phone call.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, we don't really prepare people as we get older in life, especially with the elderly group. We don't actually prepare that actually we're all on that journey, whether it be 2 months' time, whether it be, for me, 40 years, 50 years, who knows? We don't know our own journey. But I know that once my journey would start, I would want that support to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take it back to when we talk about eating and drinking. I think Bob is going to talk about our palliative and nutrition MDT and how it all came about, really. Because we recognize nutrition is a very emotive topic. Emotive in respects of, people think that if I feed you and, you know, that you're going to get better. How can mum get better? Because she's having no food. I'll give you an example. Only last week, and this is, I say last week, but this is a regular enough issue, really, for us here in the hospital. An elderly lady was admitted. Unfortunately, she had a fall. By the time I met her, mum already had an NG in. She an NG tube to help her feed, because she wasn't really waking up. She had had a hip fracture secondary to a fall. But actually, when I did my background investigation, this lady had refused medical intervention for 5 years. She was well in her 90s, and she was a very frail lady, lived next door to her daughter, and daughter was very much knowing and very much accepting when I spoke to her that mum for 5 years really has been slowly dying.
Mm.
But when she came in here, she said that the doctors very much acted like, well, we can fix mom, we can sort all this out. So by the time I met mom, I didn't feel any of this was, and I brought this particular case to our palliative nutrition MDT. And when I went to speak to the daughter, and we had a long time chatting, the daughter felt very reassured that all she wanted was to bring mom home, because mom had for 5 years refused medical intervention. And mum was very, very comfortable, no longer felt hungry. And this is one of my biggest questions when we talk at our meetings about our complex patients is, are they hungry? Do they feel hungry? Because we have to start with, how does a patient feel? And once we know how the patient feels, then I can work with the patient. It's always such an individualized case. But our experience can be that artificial feeding, especially in end of life, creates a burden and a barrier without many benefits to the actual patient. Patient comfort and holistic approach should always be our first focus.
I think we basically 4 years ago or thereabouts, we were having mutual patients, and we decided, rather than making this sort of an informal arrangement, to actually have a formal MDT discussion. And eventually we formed a group which meets on a Wednesday morning with the gastroenterology team, nutrition team, speech and language, dietitian and palliative care, really trying to look at these patients with complex needs.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to look at the issues that they're facing as individuals. And I think the sorts of things that we particularly try and address is, does the patient have capacity to make their own decisions? What are their own wishes? Have they got any pre-existing documents, like an advanced decision to refuse treatment?
Mm.
Or have they ever let their families know about their wishes informally? And I think it's important to decide, yes, have they got capacity, or is this actually going to be a circumstance where we have to act in the patient's best interests? Mm. And that's obviously in a sort of different league, and we've then got to take into the account previously expressed wishes and those of healthcare professionals, and the sort of questions about what are we actually trying to achieve, what are our goals of treatment, and you know, what's the outlook for this patient as a whole. Mm. I think we've often found these decisions very difficult, but we're there hopefully to try and support our colleagues in the hospitals with, you know, if they've got particularly complex patients. So I think it's over the course of about the 4-year period that we've been running, about 200 patients or more have been discussed.
Mm, there's clearly a lot of complexity out there, and I think often patients that are the most challenging are the ones where it's a matter of trying to figure out their best interests. And as you've touched on earlier, Cleona, that if eating and drinking is such an emotive subject, that trying to, well, sometimes coming to a conclusion where artificially assisted nutritional hydration is not in someone's best interest almost seems sort of counterintuitive at the most sort of basic level. And actually weighing up what they would have liked, as you said, Bob, and considering is there an overall benefit to this, you know, that's kind of maybe another way of thinking about it, because it's hard to tell yourself that it isn't in somebody's interest to be fed sometimes. And yes, I think people find it difficult to wrap their heads around that, don't they?
Yes, very much.
Equally, people, I think, find a lot of issue with what we were discussing earlier, a term called risk-managed feeding.
Yes.
I'll let you talk a little bit more about that.
So, yes, and risk feeding, I think going back historically, many years ago, I think we used to call it comfort feeding, if my memory serves me right. This is when we've exhausted all options, really. We've exhausted all options from an enteral point of view or a parental point of view, either way, artificial. And that exhausting could have happened along with the patient. It could have been that we've actually had this journey with the patient and the patient has been very much come to the conclusion, no, I want to eat and drink. Mm. Yes, does it carry risk? Well, it will carry risk, and that usually comes from having had a video fluoroscopy to confirm that it carries risks. And the speech and language therapist will very much be on that journey with that patient. Our difficulty there is maybe find that word uncomfortable, that word risk uncomfortable, but you can't remove that word either, because at the same time, there's risks for all of us in life. And this is where I always kind of come back to basics with the medical team and the families and say, I have patients who are mobile, who have been risk feeding for 4 to 7 years in the community, fully mobile, doing really, really well, really good mouth care and mobility. I mean, those patients can do very, very well. If somebody is bedbound and they have poor mouth care, just their own saliva alone is going to become a risk. Not just, you don't have to introduce anything extra. So really good mouth care is definitely a number one issue, a number one thing that will definitely minimize your risk. But to remove risk, unfortunately, we can't remove risk in life.
Yeah.
And just the term risk feeding to this day, I just think that we haven't quite got that right yet.
Yeah, and healthcare professionals in general are risk
averse.
Yeah,
yes,
completely. And so it's trying to keep the focus on, well, okay, accepting the acknowledged risk we've talked about earlier, but keeping the focus on, well, what does the patient want? What will give them the best quality? And again, if it's a question of capacity. It's trying to come to the conclusion of, you know, what would they have chosen if they had been fully able to give capacity with full understanding and things. But the other thing about risk was the risks associated with the treatments that are offered. And I think there's a misconception that with NG feeding and PEG, it will stop people aspirating, but actually not true. Yeah.
No, not true. And with a PEG, we could insert a PEG tomorrow, but you'll still have a risk of aspirating just on your own saliva alone. So we cannot remove that risk. I think the biggest thing I would say is we get too distracted sometimes when patients especially are coming to end of life by nutrition and risks and all these words that actually really patient's comfort and family time is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, that's very true.
And realistic expectations of what we can actually deliver.
And then just quickly sort of thinking about the things that we can do on the wards to support patient's comfort and enjoyment as much as possible when eating and drinking. We've talked a bit about mouth care and the importance of that, making sure it's well hydrated, no thrush, clean dentures, well-fitting dentures if possible. And then probably other common things are adapting consistencies, and that's with the input of our colleagues from speech and language, dietitians with supplements, and also some time. So if possible, having the healthcare assistants and nursing staff assist with meal times, or if we can, obviously with pandemic and things are different, but getting family members in during meal times and that social interaction as well for the patient.
And we have a red tray system as well in this trust where we'll actually be able to identify that this patient takes a little bit longer than the other patients to eat and drink. And very often I will come up and I will actually speak to matrons and we will get a one-to-one for a patient if they need that actual individual time to eat and drink. There's lots of things. As long as the right people are in the room and as long as the right people are involved, we can make these things happen.
And then sort of just finally talking about the last days of life and where people stop eating and drinking, they lose that drive. There's no really long, there's not the hunger and the thirst that people would normally expect. And we often get asked, oh, are you just going to let mum or dad starve to death? And, you know, a useful way of explaining it is that they aren't they're not dying because they're not eating and drinking. They're not eating and drinking because they're dying, unfortunately. Yes. And I've also heard it put that the physiology of dying, the kind of deterioration of the swallow, the sleeping more and more, that is the body's way of protecting itself from getting food and drink that it can't handle anymore. And trying to bypass those safety mechanisms with tubes is just, it doesn't change the outcome and it just causes more burden
distress
and suffering. Exactly.
And distress. I think people forget the distress and the uncomfortableness of having an NG put down your nose and all those when the outcome is not going to be really, we've again just caused a distraction for the family, caused a distraction when really the reality is this is what's happening. So let's not deceive the people around us, because a lot of the time the patient is already knows if they have capacity, they already know.
So why rob them of that time with these other things?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. That was there was a lot, and there's a lot more to talk about, to be honest. Any of us would be happy to have those conversations if people wanted to get in touch. But equally, don't forget about the nutrition MDTs that happen. Always happy to discuss complex patients, and eating and drinking is often some of the most challenging decisions that we come across. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you
for listening to another one of our episodes. We just wanted to let you know that we are evaluating these podcasts with a very short Survey Monkey. So if you've been listening to our podcast series Teaching for Our Time, we would love you to go to the link which is in the notes at the bottom of this episode and take 1 minute of your time to answer the 10 very quick and easy questions that are there so that we can gather some data to know what we've done well, what we could do differently, and to write up what has been for us a really exciting and rewarding project. So we're not finished yet, but we just want to evaluate at this point. So find the link and fill out the questionnaire. We really appreciate you doing that. Thanks so much.